It's time for justice. Welcome to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, heard every Wednesday from 12:30 to 1 p.m. on 97.3 FM WRIR. I'm your host, Marty Wegbright. This show is written and produced by Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. We give free, civil, non-criminal legal aid to low-income people in Richmond, Petersburg, Charlottesville, and surrounding cities and counties. Coming up on this week's show...
A perfect example of that would be the congresswoman from Arizona who recently, a few months ago, was shot in the head, and obviously now, since she's undergoing rehabilitation, is unable to handle her own financial affairs.
Private attorney Frank Feibelman explains when a guardian is needed and the complicated process by which a court appoints one. And during this week's question and answer session, we discuss the difference between a Chapter 7 and a Chapter 13 bankruptcy and when you might want to file one or the other. All that and more coming up. Stay with us. The show is supported in part by a grant from the Virginia Law Foundation. This show, number 120, is the sole responsibility of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society and gives only general legal information. If you have a legal problem and need specific legal advice about your situation, contact an attorney. If you can't afford an attorney, we'll tell you later in the show how to get free legal advice or representation in a civil case. The Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show is heard every Wednesday at 12:30 on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio, and is made possible by community radio volunteers at WRIR. And now, this week's news you can use. Last month, the U.S. Department of Justice issued a letter finding that Virginia is in violation of the Americans with Disabilities Act in the operation of its developmental disabilities services. The 21-page letter concludes that Virginia does not serve its residents with intellectual disabilities in the most integrated setting possible, and that Virginia further violates the Americans with Disabilities Act by maintaining a waiting list for community-based services that exceeds 3,000 people. DOJ concludes that the discharge process at Central Virginia Training Center and other training centers is inadequate and that staff at training centers are not knowledgeable about the availability of community services. The letter is strongly worded and highly critical, and describes many outrageous examples of individuals being kept in institutions for decades unnecessarily. However, the DOJ also commends the governor for cooperation in the investigations and expresses hope that the Commonwealth will continue working toward an amicable and cooperative agreement to resolve the findings. In other news, according to a study by Experian, one of the three major credit bureaus in the U.S., Richmond, Virginia is ninth among the top 25 cities with the most credit card debt. According to the survey, the average U.S. credit card holder owed more than $4,200 at the end of December. Fortunately, that's a decline of about 4% compared to the end of December 2009, and 8% compared to December 2007. In Richmond, the average credit card balance was $4,771, just $406 below the top city, San Antonio, Texas. At the same time, the average number of bank-issued credit cards has declined to 1.97 cards per customer, a drop of 23% since 2007. That's a mixed blessing, however. With fewer cards in their wallets, Americans are tapping more of each card's available balance. The result is that consumers are using more than 30% of their total available bank card balance, a jump of nearly 10 percentage points since 2007. Credit counselors say consumers would be well advised to restrain their dependence on credit cards whenever possible and follow common sense tips such as assessing their overall financial situation, first paying down the credit cards that carry the highest interest rates, and considering the use of tax refunds to lower credit card debts. With this week's news you can use, this is your host, Marty Wegbright. Hey, You're listening to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio.
This week's case that changed the Commonwealth is Doe versus Dooling. Two unmarried adults in the city of Richmond, using the names James and Jane Doe, claimed they engaged in sexual intercourse with unmarried members of the opposite sex and cohabited with a member of the opposite sex. They challenged the constitutionality of Virginia's fornication and cohabitation statutes. In 1985, the U.S. District Court for the Eastern District found the laws to unconstitutionally violate the right to privacy and enjoined Richmond's chief of police and Commonwealth attorney from enforcing these statutes. A year later, the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals vacated the decision, in part because there had been no reported conviction for cohabitation since 1883 and no reported conviction for fornication since 1849. Although these remain illegal, it appears no one is being prosecuted. For the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, I'm Diane Dussault, and Doe versus Dooling is this week's case that changed the Commonwealth.
Welcome back to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio. We're here in the studio with this week's questioner, and it's time for our question and answer session. Would you please tell us your name and where you're from?
Shay from Henrico.
Welcome to the show. Shay, what question do we have this week?
What is the difference between filing for Chapter 7 and Chapter 13 bankruptcy?
Well, Shay, that's an excellent question because a lot of people get those two mixed up. A Chapter 7 bankruptcy, you ask the court to forgive you from the legal responsibility for paying for debts that are dischargeable, and most of your debts are dischargeable. You don't have to pay any money to anybody. A Chapter 13 bankruptcy, you ask the court to allow you to reorganize your debts and perhaps pay less than the full amount owed on some of those debts, but the primary thing about a Chapter 13 is that you do have to pay some money in order to keep your property and in order to discharge your debts. If you are at or below the area median income, you can file either a Chapter 7 or a 13. If you're at or above the area median income, you must file a Chapter 13. You're not allowed to file a Chapter 7. Now, both bankruptcies start the same way. You list all of your income, you list all of your expenses, you list all of your property, you list all of your debts. Then you are allowed to protect a certain amount of property in either type of bankruptcy, basically $5,000 of personal property, a motor vehicle worth $2,000, and an additional $5,000 if you list it with a homestead deed. If everything that you've listed is protected, then you're a good candidate for Chapter 7. You discharge your debts and you move on with your life. If everything you list is not protected, you may need to file a Chapter 13 to protect it. And basically the rule, and this is a very important rule, is that the creditor must do at least as well under a Chapter 13 and get at least as much as the creditor would have gotten under a Chapter 7. So if you have property that you would lose if you filed a Chapter 7 but could keep by making some payments under a Chapter 13, then a Chapter 13 is definitely for you. And of course, for people who are above the area median income, they have to file a 13. So the basic rule is if you have little or nothing to protect and you just can't pay your creditors at all, you file a Chapter 7. If you have something to protect that you can keep if you pay for it, like, for example, a car or occasionally a house, then you file a Chapter 13. Does that explain the difference to you enough?
Yes, thank you very much.
Okay, thank you for being on the show.
Turn me around, I'm gonna keep on walking, keep on talking.
Welcome back to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio. We're here at the law office of private attorney Frank Feibelman in the near west end of Enrico County. Frank has been in private practice for the past 37 years, primarily in real estate, but also handles guardianships and conservatorships, and that's what we will be talking about today. Welcome to the show, Frank.
Thank you very much, Marty.
Well, tell our listeners, Frank, what is an adult guardianship?
An adult guardianship is an order by a circuit court appointing someone, the guardian, to handle the personal affairs of the person who doesn't have the capability, usually intellectual capability, of handling his own personal affairs. So the guardian has the power to act in place of the person who needs a guardian.
And we mentioned earlier the term conservatorship. That's, I gather, different than a guardian. Can you describe what a conservatorship is?
Yes. A conservatorship is when a person is appointed as conservator to handle the financial and property affairs of the ward. The ward is the person who is incompetent.
Now, when will the court actually appoint a guardian or conservator? You mentioned the person is incapable of handling their affairs. What do we mean by that?
The procedure is that a petition for the appointment of a guardian and or a conservator is filed in the circuit court of the jurisdiction where the alleged incompetent person resides. The incompetent person's closest relatives are notified of the filing of the petition. The court appoints what's called a guardian ad litem, which is a lawyer who's appointed to represent the best interest of the alleged incompetent person. That does not mean that the guardian ad litem does what the alleged incompetent wants him to do, but comes to his or her own decision as to what's in the best interest of the alleged incompetent person. The petitioner, when they go to court, have to prove, and they usually do this by a letter from a doctor who is familiar with the alleged incompetent. The letter states in what areas of life the alleged incompetent is incompetent to handle his own affairs. It may be limited to, for example, just handling his own financial affairs. In that case, only a conservator would be appointed by the court, and there would be no guardian appointed to handle the personal affairs of the alleged incompetent. In a majority of the cases, both a guardian and a conservator, who can be the same person or appointed, because persons who, for example, because of old age and senility, are incapable of making either personal or financial decisions, need both a guardian and a conservator appointed.
Okay, so let's take that step by step. You mentioned that certain people have to be notified when the petition is filed. Who has to be notified, and how is that done?
The heirs at law, if the alleged incompetent person were dead, have to be notified. That's children, spouses, and if there are no children or spouse, then the brothers and sisters of the alleged incompetent. It's done by mailing to the relatives a copy of the petition for the appointment of a guardian. That's done at the same time that the petition is filed with the circuit court.
Now, you mentioned the necessity for medical evidence and the report that has to be filed, I guess, with the court. How do you obtain that medical evidence? And in particular, how would you obtain it if the alleged incapacitated person were to be stubborn and say, I'm fine, I don't need anybody to take care of me, I'm not going?
Two ways to do it. One is for the attorney for the proposed guardian or conservator to write the doctor a letter, explain why the guardian or his attorney needs the current medical state of the proposed incompetent, and most doctors who have recently seen the alleged incompetent in their medical offices will realize that any written consent is not worth anything because the person doesn't have the mental capacity to knowingly give consent. If the treating physician who has recently seen the alleged incompetent won't write a letter without the written consent of the alleged incompetent, a subpoena ducis tecum, which is a subpoena for medical records or written material, can be requested by the attorney for the proposed guardian, issued by the court, commanding the physician to turn over the medical records of the proposed guardian. The reason that is only done when it's absolutely necessary is a physician can be asked certain questions and give short answers to those questions, which are much easier readable by the court and by lawyers than trying to go through the physician's office medical records, which are written in medical jargon.
Okay, now you mentioned the guardian ad litem. That's the attorney appointed by the court to look after the interests of the alleged incapacitated person. What does the guardian ad litem specifically do?
The first thing they have to do is review the petition, the order appointing them as guardian ad litem, the letter from the treating physician, and they have to meet with the proposed incompetent wherever the alleged incompetent is residing and talk to the incompetent as best they can to come to their own conclusion as to what's in the best interest of the alleged incompetent. The guardian ad litem should also talk to the attorney for the proposed guardian to find out what the plan is in terms of the proposed residence and the plan for caring for the alleged incompetent, to come to their own conclusion that all of that is appropriate, considering the alleged incompetent's position in life.
What happens at the hearing to appoint the guardian or the conservator?
The attorney for the proposed guardian puts on evidence, submits a copy of the physician's letter, and puts on whatever other evidence as to the extent of the estate of the proposed incompetent and the plan for caring for the incompetent. Those witnesses are subject to cross-examination by the guardian ad litem. The court will then decide whether or not it's legally appropriate to appoint a conservator or guardian, and will also determine whether or not it is appropriate to safeguard the estate of the incompetent to require what's called a surety for the guardianship. A surety is either posting a cash bond or paying an insurance company a premium to post surety. Obviously, most people use an insurance company because they don't want to pay that much cash into the court and have it just sit there.
Well, once a guardian or conservator is appointed, what are the powers and duties that that person has?
Well, if they're appointed both conservator and guardian, then their first duty is to make an appropriate choice of residence for the ward, which means either a nursing home, in their own residence, or in the residence of the guardian, and making sure there's appropriate medical care in terms of a nurse's aide or a hospital, depending on the condition of the ward. If they're appointed as conservator, then they handle the money and other property of their ward and make an annual accounting to a person appointed by the court to the position of commissioner of accounts, who makes sure that the estate is handled appropriately and either approves or disapproves the accounting on a yearly basis.
So all of this, all of the actions of the guardian and the conservator are under some degree of court supervision?
Yes.
Okay, well, if a guardianship or conservatorship is appointed, can it ever be removed? And if so, how does that happen?
The guardianship can be removed by a petition filed either by the guardian or the ward asking that the guardianship or conservatorship be dissolved. Obviously, one of the requirements is medical evidence that a guardianship or conservatorship is no longer necessary because the ward is now able to handle his or her own affairs. A perfect example of that would be the congresswoman from Arizona who recently, a few months ago, was shot in the head, and obviously now, since she's undergoing rehabilitation, is unable to handle her own financial affairs. But from what I've read in the news and heard in the news, she's progressing so quickly in rehabilitation that soon she will be able to handle her own affairs.
And in your experience, how often does a case arise where a guardian or a conservator is appointed, but then later there are grounds for removing that guardian or conservator?
Unfortunately, it doesn't happen very frequently because guardianship is most often used for people who are elderly and are suffering from senility or dementia, which is not reversible medically. So the guardianship lasts until the death of the ward.
And finally, are there alternatives to a guardianship or conservatorship?
Yes, there are. And that is something called a durable power of attorney, which is a written instrument signed by the person before a notary public appointing somebody else as attorney in fact to handle his or her own affairs that will also survive the disability of the person signing the power of attorney. Not only is this a simpler procedure, but it's also much less costly.
And I gather this is something that private attorneys such as you handle on a regular basis as well.
Yeah, yes, much more frequently. It's quite often done as part of estate planning when a will or a trust is prepared.
Thank you very much. We have been speaking with private attorney Frank Feibelman. He is in the near west end of Henrico County and has been in practice for 37 years, handling primarily real estate, but also guardianship, conservatorship, and other estate planning matters. Thank you so much for being on the show, Frank.
You're welcome.
This week's Strange But True Law is from Title 8.01, which deals with civil remedies and procedures. Under Code of Virginia 8.01-401.2:1, a podiatrist shall not be permitted to testify as an expert witness against a doctor of medicine or osteopathic medicine in connection with a medical malpractice civil court proceedings or a medical malpractice review panel in any case where the doctor or osteopath is a defendant in such proceeding. What's so strange about this law is not just its existence, but that it was passed in last year's 2010 General Assembly session with the specific finding that an emergency exists and this act is in force from its passage on April 13, 2010. The law is less than a year old. And already we're forgotten just what was the emergency that prompted its passage. For the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, I'm Michelle King, and that's this week's Strange But True Law.
That's all for this week's Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. The show is heard every Wednesday from 12:30 to 1 p.m. The show is the sole responsibility of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. To see if you can get free civil legal aid, call during intake hours. These are Monday through Thursday, 9 a.m. to 11:30 a.m. and 1 p.m. to 2:30 p.m. The phone number is 200-6046 for intake, 648-1012 for the main number, and 1-800-868-1012 to call toll-free. If you have any comments on the show, you can email them to marty@cvlas.org. In addition, every first-run Central Virginia Legal Aid radio show ever broadcast is now available at www.radioforall.net. That's radio, the numeral 4, all.net. Then click the contributor link. Then click Marty Wegbright, Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. This show provides only general legal information. If you have a legal problem and need specific legal advice about your situation, contact an attorney. If you can't afford one, call Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. While the court system is the way disputes traditionally have been resolved, there now are new and different ways of resolving conflict, ways that give more control over the outcome to the parties themselves. Join us next Wednesday at 12:30 p.m. when private attorney and mediator Andrew Wood talks about mediation and other options for resolving disputes outside of court in a rebroadcast of the show originally heard on November 4, 2009. That's Law for the Rest of Us next week on the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. I'm Marty Wegman.